the Ortho PAC, hosted by Sam Dyer. Welcome to the Ortho PAC, where we discuss up-to-date orthopedic topics for the busy clinician. I invite you to sit back and relax as I attempt to fill in the gaps between education, current events, and real-world practice.
Welcome back today, listeners. We continue listening to the prior presentation from Dr. Jake Drew from a 2018 Charlotte meeting on the difficult primary hip planning and execution. Dr. Drew will talk today about the developmental dysplasia of the hip, instability issues, trunnionosis, and problems with offsets and leg length and changes in version in a total hip. Thanks for listening, and I hope to see you soon.
So let's talk for a minute about developmental dysplasia of the hip. In years gone past, when this was not treated in early childhood or infancy, there was a greater incidence of folks walking around out there with very severely dysplastic hips as young adults. Now, that still happens, but with far less frequency now that the pediatricians are more aware of this problem and can address it early on. There's some classification systems out there that talk about the aspects of developmental dysplasia. By far, most of the dysplastic hips you're going to see going on to arthritis nowadays are going to be of the mild variety. So that would be this picture on the left labeled dysplastic here. You still might see some that fall into the middle or far right categories, low dislocation or high dislocation. And those have some particular challenges that are probably a talk in and of themselves. But the mildly dysplastic hips are going to come up enough that it's good to talk about the ways to address the specific characteristics of those hips. So on the acetabular side, in the setting of dysplasia, the acetabulum is by definition shallow. It's often very small, often retroverted. And as a result, there's a lack of bony coverage, typically anteriorly and laterally. On the femoral side, typically the canal is quite narrow. And keep in mind, a lot of these patients, when they get to you for hip replacement, these are going to be the younger patients because they've had a congenital abnormality that led to osteoarthritis at a far earlier age than the typical wear and tear processes where we see granny in the office. So these patients are very young. They have very thick cortices, and the canal is, as a result, very narrow. So you can have a mismatch between the bony anatomy proximally and the bony anatomy more distally. Typically, the femoral side in a dysplastic hip will demonstrate excessive aniversion and often a very short and valgus femoral neck. As a result, the soft tissues are shorter, the abductors are more horizontal, and the femoral nerve vascular bundle is in a more vulnerable position. And so how do we address those issues? On the acetabular side, where the cup is shallow, under-antiverted, and often with a lack of bony coverage, the best solution is often to medialize your acetabular component. So in this picture here, you can see the acetabular component has actually broken through the medial wall. That's okay. You can put a little defect in the medial wall, put a huge defect in the medial wall. That's a different situation. But a small defect in the medial wall can help you achieve better bony coverage and a better anterior-posterior press fit. The size of these cups is based on the anterior-posterior dimension. So if you try to catch up to the medial lateral dimension, you'll keep going up, 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 and all of a sudden you'll have no anterior posterior wall, and you'll have a really difficult time achieving a press fit. So this CT scan cross section shows how when you medialize that acetabular component, you can achieve that anterior posterior press fit, excellent bony coverage, and even dial in a little bit more antiversion. Oftentimes, even when you medialize, you're still going to end up with a lot of your cup uncovered. So you look down into the wound and there's all this metal porous coating that's not contacting bone. That's okay. Up to 40% of that cup can be uncovered as long as you have a solid press fit. And again, most of that press fit is going to be anterior posterior. So if you have that superlateral cup uncoverage, you're going to be okay. You're still going to have a solid cup. Now, with the more severely dysplastic hips, when there's a false acetabulum above the native acetabulum, you're going to have to use some different techniques, which, again, are probably beyond the scope of this discussion. On the femoral side, we spoke about the metaphyseal-diaphyseal mismatch, so a very narrow canal, wide metaphysis. Oftentimes, that's appropriately addressed with modular stems. So an SROM stem that's depicted here is a good option for that type of bony abnormality. You can use the modularity such that you can use a very narrow canal-filling stem with a very large metaphyseal-filling sleeve. The other advantage of this type of stem is that it gives you the ability to address version. And so we'll talk about version in a moment. There's acetabular version, there's femoral version, and the combination of the two is the most important variable. If your acetabular reconstruction is limited in terms of how much antiversion you can put on your acetabular component, a stem design like this, where you have 360 degrees of available version, can help you make up for some limitations on the acetabular side with the modularity on the femoral side. So this is an example of a mildly dysplastic hip. You can see all the room that you have between the articular surface medially and the medial wall. There's a good centimeter there. And so this acetabulum, where it lays right now, is rather shallow. And you can take a look on the other side and see how much of a difference there is there. And so to address that acetabulum, my preoperative planning would include medializing that acetabular component quite a bit. When you do that, you have to make up that offset somewhere else, and that somewhere else is going to be on the femoral side. So typically, often, you're going to need a high offset femoral stem to make up for the offset that you lose by aggressively medializing the acetabular component. And so the end result, this is, again, a mildly dysplastic hip. So that tight canal was still acceptable in terms of getting a standard stem. Medialize the acetabular component, make up the offset with the femoral stem. You can address some of those issues we talked about without changing your standard technique a whole lot and using conventional components. Now, in the case of a more severely dysplastic hip like this one, where there's a false acetabulum superior to the true acetabulum, it's going to be awfully difficult to use standard components and have a stable, well-reconstructed hip. So in this situation, this is not one of my own cases. They did some bone grafting superlaterally to provide a little more coverage for that acetabular component. You can see how much they've medialized that acetabular component. And on the femoral side, they actually did a femoral shortening osteotomy. This femur has been short by a couple of centimeters, several centimeters, for the entire length of this patient's life. And so that's different than a traumatic deformity. So if you've got a hip fracture and the femur is short for a few months before they finally show up and get a hip replacement, that's different than a situation where this femoral nerve, or sciatic nerve specifically, have been short for 20, 30, 40 years. If you come in and all of a sudden acutely lengthen them by more than 2.5 centimeters is the quoted number, now you're at risk of a nerve palsy that may or may not be transient or permanent. And so you can't lengthen a leg by 6 centimeters without risking that significant consequence. And so in this situation, a femoral shortening osteotomy is necessary to achieve a stable hip without risking neuropraxia. And in that situation, again, the modular component on the femoral side can facilitate the osteotomy and also give the ability to dial inversion wherever you need it. This acetabular component has very little, if any, antiversion built in. You can rebuild, restore that antiversion on the femoral side with that modular stem. Complication rate for dysplastic hips is higher than that for standard arthritic hips. It's related to the severity of the disease. Nerve palsies, if you lengthen more than 2.5 centimeters, if you need to do an osteotomy, there's a risk of non-union. Because of extensile exposures, there's a risk of heterotopic ossification. And there's some dislocation risk here. So anytime you have to put in a very small cup, you're limited in how large the head can be with resultant increased risk of dislocation. And again, we spoke a little bit about the version abnormalities that exist here. And so instability issues, if the hip is not stable intraoperatively, what do you do? First of all, you have to know your patient. So stability can vary depending on a patient. Some patients are in need of a more stable hip than others. So this guy might need a more stable hip than grandpa who just needs to go back and forth from the bingo hall to his room. And so you need to know these things about your patients before you get to the operating room so that you know what's acceptable or not. For my anterior hips, I don't do a whole lot in terms of assessment of dynamic stability. Really, the only dynamic test I do is with the hip in neutral, I externally rotate it to 90 degrees and I don't want to see any subluxation. So I'm looking for no anterior instability. I don't test posterior stability in my anterior hips. I have some surrogates for that, however. I can test the axial shock, the lateral shock, how tight are the soft tissues, how difficult is it to reduce that hip. And those give me an idea of if I'm putting the hip back at the appropriate parameters in terms of offset and length. And of course, you're looking at an x-ray with an anterior hip. So you've got a sense if you're putting parts back in where they ought to be in terms of length, offset, and version. For posterior hip, I do want to assess posterior stability. So for that, I flex to 90 degrees and test internal rotation. I want to have at least 70 degrees of internal rotation before that hip is starting to slip out. Beware of the pelvic positioner, particularly in the larger patients. Sometimes that pelvic positioner is a little more distal than you want, or the pannus can get in the way, and that can artificially give you a sense of instability. So beware of that, particularly in the larger patients. Don't rely on your capsular repair. Don't rely on your patient to adhere to posterior hip precautions. If you're leaving the OR with an unstable hip, it's not likely to get any better from there on out. So you got to do more. And so a lot of times the first thing people think about if the hip's not stable intraoperatively is trying to address the parts. So go to a larger head, a longer neck length, et cetera, et cetera. I would suggest that addressing bony impingement should be step one and then change the parts afterwards as needed. So what I mean by bony impingement. So not uncommonly, there's excess bone at the anterior trochanter and or the anterior aspect of the acetabulum, where if left alone, when you internally rotate that hip, that proud bone is going to impinge and causes the hip to lever out the back. And so the picture on the left here shows the space, which yields the arc of motion, before you resect that bone. And then after you resect that abnormal bony prominence, you have a much larger arc of motion before you get impingement, before that hip is going to lever out the back. So for me, this is the first thing I'll address if I have any concerns about instability intraoperatively. And the second thing I'll address is the parts. So obviously, if you go up in head size, it's more stable, right? So why does this help? The larger head size in relation to a consistent neck dimension gives you a larger arc of motion before you get impingement. So as soon as that femoral neck impinges on the acetabular component, that's when you're going to have a levering effect and the hip is going to lever itself out and dislocate. Larger head gives you a greater arc of motion before that occurs. Jump distance. So the greater the diameter of the femoral head, the greater distance it has to travel before it jumps out of that acetabulum. All right. So those are the ways where a larger head yields increased stability. There are no free lunches, however. So trunnionosis is something that we appreciate more and more as time goes on. Related to metal-metal disease that we know so much about. So metal-metal bearings cause metal ions, which yield pseudotumors, all sorts of problems. You can get the same sequela even without a metal-metal articulation. And it's thought to be related to the taper and the femoral head. Probably more common based on the biomechanical aspects with larger heads. So if you just put a huge head in every time in an effort to gain stability, you might be placing that patient at risk of trunnionosis. So change the parts. If the plus zero doesn't work, you go to a plus five. So the downsides there is if you were happy with your leg length initially, now you're lengthening that leg. If you're happy with your offset initially, now you're adding additional offset. If you add too much offset, that patient's going to complain about trochanteric bursitis. All right. And so there are some downsides to this. Certainly adding more leg length, more offset increases the soft tissue tension and provides greater stability. So how can you add offset without altering leg length? Most implants that are available have standard and high offset options. Sometimes it's called standard and Coxavara, or is a different neck angle, but you can simply switch to a different implant geometry in order to add offset without adding leg length. On the flip side, you can add length without adding offset by sticking with the same component, perhaps going up a size and just sitting it up a little bit higher. So now you've added a few millimeters of length without changing the offset. So there's some ability to fine-tune things in order to achieve stability. Probably the most common reason for lack of stability is inappropriate version. It's going to be most common on the acetabular side. And so sometimes there's a good reason for that. Maybe there's a bony deficiency and you have to prioritize component fixation over position. What's most important is the combined version. It should probably approximate somewhere around 40 degrees. So if you get 20 on the acetabular side, 20 on the femoral side, great. Sometimes you have to do a little more on the acetabular side or more on the femoral side based on what you're dealing with in terms of bony anatomy. So there are ways to alter your acetabular version. There are face-changing liners, lip liners. Those can alter the functional or effective version of that acetabular component. On the femoral side, you can simply broach to accommodate more antiversion than the native bone would suggest. Or again, the best bailout option here is if you're really struggling, go to the modular stem, because then you have 360 degrees with which to adjust your version and dial in that hip stability. So if all else fails, those modular stem options are a nice bailout if you're trying to achieve stability.
Thank you for listening to the OrthoPAC podcast. If you want to see some of the images that you hear in this talk, this comes from prior AV recordings that are on our website. There are free resources for PAOS members. We have videos that are no longer valid for Category 1 CME that you can use as a reference. All you have to do is go to the Learning Center. Members can look at these AV recordings for free.